You're listening to a Mint podcast brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hi, I'm Shovik Das. I'm Leslie DeMonte.
And I'm Deepthi Ahuja. You're listening to Mint Etc.,
a podcast where we will talk about important developments in technology and how they will transform our lives, work, and play as we know it. Welcome to Tech Cetera. You are joining us in this new week where your host, which is me, I am joining you all the way from San Francisco. And straight off the bat, if you are anywhere in Delhi or Mumbai or even Bangalore, I'm told, San Francisco is a far cry, especially in terms of the weather. Leslie, you're in Bangalore. Are you facing the same heat wave that we've been facing in the other cities?
No, so the heat wave has been called off, sort of, not called off, rather. I mean, they're saying
it's interesting to know that the heat wave has been called off.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think the nature has called it off for now, at least in the states of Karnataka and some other states officially. So I know we don't have much control, and we'll be talking about the Northern Lights and the solar storms. So this is an interesting segue. But yeah, as of now, Bangalore is cool. Bengaluru is cooler and have a lot of thunderstorms, not solar storms, fortunately. Yeah,
which is very cool. In fact, it was a bit of a shocker for me to know that it's regular for San Francisco to report a summer evening at 10, 12 degrees
Celsius. It is applicable to the whole of North America, for that matter of fact.
So, right.
You know that I lived in Canada for a long time. So it's a very common occurrence out there. So, yeah.
Which is quite nice. But also, we are when we are talking about cool things, we must talk about a new model by OpenAI. Of course, there was a lot of speculation, and Sam Altman came out to deny that ChatGPT search is not going to be launched. But instead, OpenAI has launched something called ChatGPT 4.0. If you'd want to take us through what ChatGPT 4.0 is and why is it important for us, Leslie?
Yeah, I mean, important for us is a very questionable thing, but yes. So definitely it's a new model. I mean, everybody had anticipated that, I've been given all the kind of talks that around, or the buzz around OpenAI. Everybody was expecting either GPT 4.5 Turbo or the GPT 5 and a GPT search engine, which would, you know, give out real-time information. But and if you remember that that buzz sort of, you know, got escalated because of that a model that was kind of a mysterious model, which was called I Am a Good GPT-2 chatbot. And that was already outperforming OpenAI's GPT-4 and Anthropic's Claude, the Claude Opus model on some tasks, basically. So everybody expected that this would happen. And if you remember, and I think it was 11th or 12th of May, 11th, I think, so May, that OpenAI sort of made an announcement saying that we will announce some ChatGPT and GPT-4 updates. And so again, that excitement went up. And remember that it was just 2 days before the Google I/O thing, on which is supposed to begin on 14 May, and which is the reason why you're in San Francisco. So now the interesting part is the Altman had already tempered the expectation by saying this is not going to be GPT-5, this won't be a search engine, but it will be some kind of new stuff we think people will love. But yet, you know, people kept on saying that no, either it will be a voice assistant, this, that. So a lot of speculation. Finally, yesterday night, you had Meera Murathi, CTO of OpenAI. And remember, it wasn't all so Meera Murathi came on stage and she announced the release of GPT 4.0, which, and O stands for Omni, not zero. And so there was, of course, that, you know, mix of disappointment, excitement, dismay over GPT 5 not being mentioned, which was evident on all social media sites. And of course, so GPT 4.0 was welcomed by many, but there were mixed reactions. So, yeah. I'll just run through, you know, a few features. So one, it is multimodal. It can generate any combination of text, audio, and image output.
Right.
You know, if you remember, ChatGPT users could even earlier use ChatGPT with voice mode, but the latencies were like 2.8 seconds for GPT 3.5, right. 5.4 seconds for GPT 4. This was on average. And now for GPT-4, you have it directly. So it can observe, you know, all these things together. So it's a single new model trained across, text, vision, and audio.
I'm guessing that is why it's called GPT-4 Omni.
Correct. So it's like a multimodal model. You can basically. Right. And that is the strength of it. And availability, if you want to talk about that, so OpenAI has already begun rolling out GPT-4 zeros, 4 O's, text and image capabilities in ChatGPT. It is importantly, I think all users, you know, those who are, even those who are not GPT Plus users can now access GPT 4.0. Now that's the good part of it. They have democratized the use of it. Except that right. GPT Plus users will get about 5 times higher message limits. That's the interesting thing.
Right.
Developers that's can also access GPT 4.0 in the API as a text and vision model. Performance.
Right.
It matches GPT 4 Turbo performance on text in English and code. That's what OpenAI is saying. Okay.
Right.
And it has a significant improvement on text in non-English languages. So it is because I think the tokenization has been compressed. So, you know, that is the whole thing. And they have actually given a nice comparison on 20 languages, which includes Gujarati, Marathi, Hindi, Urdu. So that you can go through that list. Pretty interesting. And how much the tokenization is reduced by, which also means that there'll be lower power consumption.
Right.
Safety point, they have said that it is undergoing, you know, extensive red teaming with some 70 plus external experts. And they've also pointed out some of the, you know, quite a few limitations of the models. And you can watch that video on, they have put up that video also over there. So it's interesting. And reactions are interesting if you watch the tweet, because obviously everybody expected GPT-5 to trend. Now GPT-4.0 is trending. So interesting. They're saying that, okay, fine. This, because it is multimodal, it's taking the industry a step closer to achieving fully autonomous contact centers, because, GPT-4.0 has the ability to understand and act on user emotion by, it can provide real-time responses. So I thought that was interesting. So these are like some of the features that I can, if it helps.
I think one of the very interesting things here is the improvement of performance in non-English languages. Because on that front, there's a lot of work that a lot of smaller companies are trying to do, trying to build on work that OpenAI has done. And Google itself is in that space, for that matter, with Gemini.
Yeah, we call it the Deshi LLM.
Right. So I was, in fact, since you mentioned this, kind of piqued my interest to kind of understand what happens. Do you expect big tech to sort of kill the sort of smaller local companies trying to build their own foundational models in sort of Indic languages?
So I don't think they will kill. They will, I mean, many of these smaller companies will probably not want to reinvent the wheel. If the tokenization, if improvement in non-English language is also pretty good, then, you know, there's no point. It sort of democratizes everything. If you remember, back in the internet days, we used to, there were those guys who knew how to create websites using HTML, the hypertext markup language.
Right.
Okay. Now, HTML code, then from HTML, many of us graduated to doing JavaScript and then, you know, Perl, Python and all those other languages. But then suddenly you had, you know, all these web-based tools which could create a whole web page on the fly, whether it was Microsoft front page, whether it was Hotdog and all those HTML press. And if you remember all those, you know, old kind of... something similar is happening now. The point is, like, everybody can create a website. Everybody has got the access to the tool. I've seen some of the demos of this GPT-4o. I mean, they'll drive you insane in the kind of the potential that they have. And it also means that anybody who has enough creativity can use it. What does it mean for smaller companies? It's a little too early to say whether many of these smaller companies will turn out to be kind of system integrators. Because see, at the end of the day, even if I have a tool, I may still want help.
Right.
My belief, personal belief at this point in time, and I'll be open to, you know, the way things pan out, because currently it's a little too early. So there are these lot of, we all know that in India itself, we have about 8 to 10 companies that are working on, you know, Deshi LLMs. I think yes, data exactly. is... Yeah, so data is the key at this point in time, because India is not only about languages, it's also about dialects.
Right.
So
right,
sometimes right. we do, you know, conveniently forget that. So I think at the and in a country like India, the dialects change every 5 kilometers. So
right.
that could perhaps, I mean, as I said, a lot more research has to be done. And, you know, we need to talk to some of these local LLM companies to understand what's happening with the dialects and the efforts that are going on there. And whether, you know, OpenAI kind of, whether GPT-4o or whatever comes after that also, can, you know, match these kind of levels, or there'll be those larger kind of languages on atop which these local languages are built, which is the case right. currently.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. In fact, that's why I've always wondered if, you know, sure, we keep speaking about that Indian companies might be better suited to understanding Indian needs and read dialects and so on, but you also kind of tend to wonder if big tech companies might sort of end up doing better in that space as well. And
yeah, it's how you look at language, na? Because there's a lot of study going on in how to understand language at the conceptual level. And so many right. other techniques have come. I mean, every second day you have a white paper on a newer technique. So
right.
I mean, jury's out, I would say, as of now. Interesting, because whether... Right. whether GPT-4o can also pick up, you know, a kind of a Marathi dialect, which is in some remote part of Maharashtra, you know, I don't know.
Absolutely.
And whether it need it also.
Right. That's the next question, whether you need it. But these big tech companies seem to be keeping a lot of stock by it, because as you mentioned at the start of this episode, that I am in San Francisco for Google I/O, and just an observation. One interesting observation is that Google I/O so far, it's Google's big developer event, and every year it used to be dominated by Android and all the sort of updates coming to Android and so
on. But they already announced.
Right. So the phone, the hardware part has already been announced. That is done with. This year, the focus is squarely on Gemini, on AI, and everything that Google is announcing. Of course, they've put a bunch of embargoes, and the embargoes are a little confusing. But I think by the time this episode is published, it'll be safe to speak about it. So Gemini is coming to pretty much every service that you can think about, and they're using... you know, AI, they have a new model for on Google DeepMind as well. They have a new DeepMind model to enable drug discovery. It's the third generation model.
You're talking of AlphaFold?
Also, yes.
Okay.
They have a new model of model for AlphaFold, and along with that, a number of Google Workspace announcements. Gemini is going to be, you know, on the side panel of all of your mainstream Google apps, and it's going to use the Gemini 1.5 Pro model. And even beyond that, there's going to be sort of Gemini in every single feature. And this year, they've got a huge sort of representation of developers across India and North America, and of course, the rest of Asia as well. Who they are opening up their APIs to. They are trying to have I was speaking with some of the developers on the ground here. One of the things that they mentioned is that most developers have taken naturally to working with OpenAI. And at least in the AI side of things, Meta and OpenAI both have a lead on Google at this moment with their Llama and GPT models. But Google seems to be sort of keeping an eye over its shoulders because...
Yeah, but Shaviq, you know, I think for the listeners, I think what would be important is to understand what would be the enhancements, whether, you know, Gmail would be enhanced with more AI, what yes. are the kind of newer features that we'll have, whether, you know, our inbox will have fewer spam filter, you know, the spam filters would be enhanced with AI, whether the hardware within our smartphones, whether... I mean, to start with all the Pixel phones before they come up with Pixel 9, I guess, because you're the expert out there. So,
right.
And, you know, so what kind of features they'll come up with, whether the search engine
just,
will be
right. So just some of the stuff over that are going to be out there, that includes Gemini email summaries and contextual smart replies, which are already there, but they're giving the 1.5 Pro model so that the replies become better. There's also going to be an inbuilt chatbot into the Gmail app where you can access Gemini and do a complete question and answer based interface, like a complete text interface, and we can ask it queries and okay. help
That's interesting because these guys are trying to integrate the LLM chatbot with the search engine and give real-time information. Google has real-time information. So, okay, now let me get you a chatbot and give me that. Interesting.
Yeah. So Google's sort of trying to, you know, cash in on its power here where, you know, it's cashing in on the fact that Gmail is there for pretty much everybody. Android is used by a vast majority of people and they're cashing in on these things. They're using giving people access to Gemini, and they are urging developers to build on them. Whether they can do it or not is the question, because one of the things that I got off the ground so far at Gemini, it's just been the first 24 hours, so there's a lot to go. But one of the things that the developers interestingly mentioned is that Google, at least in the developer circles for AI, is being perceived as a company that is too old or one that is not at the cutting edge. So developers prefer working with OpenAI and working with Microsoft, whose developer support is far more.
It's historically awesome.
And but interestingly, among users, Leslie, Google's, you know, be it Google Search or be it Gmail, yeah, I mean, or even YouTube for that matter, you know, these are the most popular platforms for us. We in India, I think 97% of us use Android phones. And I don't know if anybody, you know, uses any search engine apart from Google. Maybe some of us use DuckDuckGo for privacy, but that's about it.
It's a good point that you raised, because this is what I wanted to point out even after this when I saw this GPT-4o, is that a lot of the stuff that will come out from GPT-4o, it wants to get these people hooked on to GPT-4o. One, there are two or three things that could probably happen. They'll try to create reels within from ChatGPT itself. Okay.
Right.
So you see that they're already competing with Meta, you're already competing with YouTube because you can create videos as it is. They have shown us what Sora can do, etc.
What Sora can do,
yeah.
Yes.
So now the interesting part, if you, at this point in time, if you do not look at the hallucinations and the limitations of generative AI at this point in time, I mean, just if you ignore them for the time being, you can actually realize, because see, for YouTube also has a lot more fake videos, etc., that you can put up on YouTube.
Right. No? Of course.
Except that since it's not generative AI, the impact isn't as much as these guys. But if you sort of ignore it for a minute, you'll realize that the question that one has to ask Google, and I hope you're going to do that, is what happens to the advertising run model? Because advertising shifts from this entire thing, you know. If you get it all within in your inbox, you don't like to be disturbed with advertising.
Exactly.
So there are two things that could happen. One is the advertising model will undergo a lot of transformation, and second thing, all these services will start becoming paid subscription based models.
Right. I think there's a good chance that the latter that you mentioned, Leslie, would happen. And of course, ads would change. There is, in fact, a session on advertising separately here at Google, which is on the 16th, that is Thursday. Unfortunately, they haven't mentioned anything. So as of recording right now, we don't know what they want to announce, but there will be some AI-related changes to Google's advertisement products. But on that note, in fact, what's interesting right now is that we keep talking about all these technologies. We keep talking about all these gadgets.
I know what you're driving at.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, because, I mean, we were discussing this initially as well, because, you know, with all these sort of things at hand, the one thing that is common is that I think our lives would pretty much fall apart if our smartphone just blacks out tonight.
I don't know about our lives. I know that many youngsters,
the younger generation in particular, probably will have no idea what to do with themselves.
Gen Z, especially Gen X.
Right. And I don't think you can even just blame them for it, because they have grown up with, you know, devices all around them, right, from a very young age. We still grew up at a time where we were told to just sit quietly and sit at a corner and read a book.
But I know that you're referring to the Northern Lights and the solar storms. So that's yes. Just give our listeners a little of a context. But importantly, even the stock markets, for that matter of fact, everything that is run yes. devices, everything. So entire world could, you know, in a scenario, technically the world could collapse. Because if you remember that movie, Gerard Butler's Geostorm, where he goes to a space station because somebody has injected a virus in the space station, because the US does not want to give up the space station to other countries. So they try to, you know, create a geostorm. I know it's in the realm of sci-fi for that, but you're already seeing this sunstorm that has come up. So that is something.
Yes, and in fact, it's in fact one of the strongest solar storms noted ever in history. They've been talking about it on the same line as the infamous 1859 Carrington effect, which yes. was, you know, perhaps the strongest solar storm that we've at least documented in the history of mankind, in the history of humankind so far.
Yeah. And he was actually an amateur sky watcher, Richard Carrington. He was a London-based, so it was near England, and he was one of these amateur sky watchers. And that Carrington event is actually named after him.
Right, right. It's a fascinating story, but what strikes you is that over the years, there have been these landmark solar storms. I don't know if it's right.
It's an 11-year cycle. Shavik, it's an 11-year cycle. So if you remember,
right.
2003 Halloween was a very strong storm.
Yeah, so, it blacked out some electricity supply chains
all
in
the
South
power
Africa
grids,
and Sweden.
Yeah. So the power grid, and this time around, so the very interesting conversation that I was having with my wife, she was telling me, she lives in this thing near Niagara Falls. Now, Niagara Falls is pretty far off from even the Northern Lights, for that matter of fact, because this is North and South Poles where you find most of the effect of the auroras or the Northern Lights, as they are known. But the interesting part is she felt like, you know, flickering of all the devices, electronic devices at home. It was kind of what she was saying. This is, you know, if she's saying, if I had not known about the Northern Lights, I would have thought this is the poltergeist effect.
That's insane.
Yeah, she was feeling it. She was, and I know that she wasn't exaggerating because she's a pretty sane person. But
exactly.
The Canada House is a huge house, so I know what an eerie effect it can have at times. You know,
I would absolutely run out of that house. Yeah. I would lose my mind. But it's crazy what all can happen. I was just.
Shavik, I think you can just, you know, probably explain. I think it's important that we, you know, many of our listeners may not know what this actually means when we see a solar storm and what exactly happened. I think we just some explanation will always help. You want to start?
I mean, so I'll just start with perhaps why this happens. You know, for anyone who's interested in this, I think a solar storm happens because of a particular reaction on the absolutely outer surface of the sun. And that reaction of plasma material ends up ejecting a huge magnetic field across the entire solar system. It's actually, at this point, it's very important to marvel at how powerful our star, the sun, is, that a reaction on its surface has that impact across the solar system. Because
it is a very small star.
Yeah, it's also one of the smaller stars. It's nowhere close to the biggest stars that we found across the universe. So shudder to think what would happen if our star was one of the giants. Because of that, the sort of the magnetic field of that charged particle discharge, because when that storm happens, the particles that are excluded out of the sun's corona are all charged particles or ions, and they interact with Earth's magnetic field. Now, it's important to look at Earth's magnetic field as probably like a protective layer, which is like a first layer of defense against a solar storm. But the magnetic layer has a finite capacity. So once the charge capacity of our own magnetosphere exceeds, that's when you see the northern lights. That's when these charged particles enter the lower layers of the Earth's atmosphere and creates that reaction with particles above on the atmosphere, which is what creates these fantastic colors. And we've come to create multiple sort of really romantic tourism sections called the Northern Lights. View the Northern Lights up in your sky all over Europe and so on. But it's not just pretty. Leslie, if you'd want to speak about the actual impact of this.
No, I think basically, as you said, there are huge clouds of plasma and magnetic fields from the sun's atmosphere, which is the corona, basically. And the plasma, right. I mean, the gas, when we say huge clouds of plasma and gas, the gas is basically hydrogen and helium. So mostly right. Hydrogen, because I think 98% of that entire gas is anyway hydrogen. I think the impact is very clear, because these, whatever you're talking about, the solar flares or the solar storm, compared, the speeds also varies. Apparently, compared to solar flares, the electromagnetic, these bursts of electromagnetic radiation that travel at the speed of light, they can reach the Earth in just over 8 minutes. So,
right.
And the corona, the coronal mass ejections, which you are talking about, what you are talking about, they are technically known as that. They travel at more kind of a leisurely pace compared to the solar flares. So that's right. The interesting part. So at their highest speeds, apparently, they can travel about 3,000 kilometers per second. Now, of course, that itself is pretty strong. But, by the time they reach the Earth, it is something like 15 to 18 hours as compared to just 8 minutes, which is the light that takes normally. That's how much time it takes for the sun's light to reach us. 8 minutes, that's the speed of light that we're talking about. Now, I think from the impact point of view, they can wreak havoc with power grids, with telecommunication network, orbiting satellites, and even, expose astronauts to, dangerous doses of radiation, including high flyers, so they just...
Right. Right. And on that note, I think it's time for us to wrap this session up. Just to recap, we've seen OpenAI speak of ChatGPT, OpenAI speak of GPT-4o. This is the week when Google is going all out on Gemini, and the sun is going all out with its particles. So that pretty much sums up everything that's happening in the tech domain. There's, of course, a bit of a poetic justice here, that even at a time when a natural incident is causing us to wonder about our dependence on technology, we have technologists who are working on the next generation models that can probably completely replace, reshape the way we look at human interactions, even in niche languages. So
good. I'm glad it's making you a little more philosophical.
it is, over time, I think sometimes when I start thinking about these things, I kind of feel like I'm growing a big white beard. But I think we're still quite some time away from that. No, but Right. Thank you so much. I think that's that for this episode. As always, if you want to discuss further on the topics that we've spoken about, do join us. You'd find me and Leslie on all mainstream social media platforms, be it Twitter or LinkedIn. Do write to us, or you can email us, or send your feedback or any other ways that you want to reach out to us on. We're happy to always have a conversation. And of course, if you want to hear anything specific in the episodes to come, do write to us for that as well. And with that, we come to an end of our episode for this week. That's it this time. See you next week.
So folks, that's it for this episode. You are listening to Mint Techc.
You can reach out to us on LinkedIn if you have any questions. Our handles are in the description.
This episode was produced by me, Deepthi Ahuja. It was edited by Amrinder Singh. Catch you next week.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HD Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.hdsmartcast.com.